Welcome to another edition of The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott, associate professor and extension urban horticulturalist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, I'm Linda Chalker-Scott, and welcome back to Season 3 of The Informed Gardener. I'm your online garden advisor, bringing you current and practical scientific information to use in your own garden and landscape. And every week I try to have a theme throughout the podcast, and this week I've chosen What's Bugging You? So first, let's look at bugs in the news.
Who's walking in the garden?
Science fix online from sciencedaily.com, and I've picked out some really cool stories about insects that I think you'll like too. The first one's called Inspired by Insect Cuticle, Scientists Develop Material That's Tough and Strong. So now you have to think like a bug or about bugs. And let's take cockroaches, please. Cockroaches are incredibly tough little critters, and as you probably know, they're impossible to stomp on and squish. They are really tough, and it's because they've got an exoskeleton. So instead of an internal skeleton like people have, they've got an outer skeleton, and that has to be tough and resistant, but also has to be relatively light, like a suit of armor, but a lightweight suit of armor so they can scuttle around like cockroaches tend to do. So it has to be strong and tough so it can resist squishing, but also has to be really flexible because they've got little legs and they've got little wings, and those things have to move, so there has to be the flexibility. In some places it has to be really thin, like on their little antenna, which are really narrow. It has to have a very thin coating of this exoskeleton. So chitin is what makes up much of an insect's exoskeleton. And researchers have been looking at it for a long time to try to figure out what is it exactly that gives it that resiliency yet flexibility. And they've figured out that what it is, it's layers. So like if you were looking at laminated wood, how it's layers of wood. So these chitinous exoskeletons are layers of things. And it's a layer of the chitin, it's a layer of a sugar, and a layer of protein. And these layers go together and they are kind of glued together and they give this resiliency and thickness and strength. So at Harvard, they were able to actually mimic this using the same types of material to make this very clear film that has basically the same structure and composition. Now, this is where you can tell that they are researchers and not marketers, because the name of this stuff is just impossible to pronounce. It's called Shrilk. It has one vowel in it. It's got an I, and all the rest of it's consonants, and they all kind of blend together. And the reason they call it that is because they made it out of the protein that's in silk, so there's that ilk part, and then they use the chitin from discarded shrimp exoskeletons. Because shrimp are relatives of insects, they all belong to the same big group. And in the shrimp industry, of course, they've got all these leftover, you know, exoskeletons after you peel the shrimp, that what's left is the chitin. So they used shrimp, that's the shr part, and they used the silk, which is the ilk part, so they got Shrilk. That's where the name comes from, and try to say that time, Shrilk many times fast, it just doesn't work. But what they're seeing with this, it's kind of a neat material. It's low cost, biodegradable, it's green, it's using, you know, leftover material from another industry, in this case shrimp production, and they're seeing that it might be a good alternative to plastics. It's biodegradable, it's natural, you could use it to make plastic bags, you could use it to make disposable diapers. All these things, they have to be tough, they have to be resistant, but they break down naturally. It's nothing synthetic. They're even saying that it could be used in medicine to suture wounds as being a way of holding, you know, like hernia repair, you know, where you're trying to keep everything back in, and it has to be pretty strong material. This stuff would be nice and strong, would be able to resist a lot of pressure, and then eventually it breaks down as the hernia heals. But the first thing they need to do is get a new name. It has to be something that doesn't sound like you're talking around a mouthful of marbles.
I beg your pardon. I never promised you a rose garden along with the sunshine. There's gotta be a little rain sometime.
Second story I found is called Eat and Let Die. Insect feeds on toxic plants for protection from predators. And we've known for years that this is what insects do. They eat toxic plants and it keeps them from getting eaten by other things. And the classic example of this, and any of you that have been in biology for a while are going to remember, there is a story about milkweeds and monarch butterflies. And that the milkweed is a toxic plant and the larva of monarch butterflies only feeds on milkweed. And then they turn into their lovely little orange and black butterfly version. And if they're fed to birds, and these are birds that aren't aware of the fact they're toxic, the birds try to eat them and immediately throw up. So there's these great pictures of these poor little blue jays or whatever they are that are vomiting up these monarchs because they're so toxic. And the birds learn that they're toxic and they won't eat them. And this is obvious in their coloration. So when you see really bright coloration, it's called warning coloration. So orange and black, red and black, yellow and black, those things are warning signals. I'm toxic. Don't eat me. And a lot of insects use that. And for a very good reason, because, you know, you're going to throw up if you eat those things. So people have wondered for a while, though, how do the insects not die? Because the insects are eating the toxic plant. Why don't they die? So you have to understand a little bit about how the toxin works. So the plant produces these alkaloids, and we're familiar with lots of alkaloids, things like caffeine and nicotine are alkaloids. And these alkaloids are produced by the plant, and they're not toxic when they're in the plant. And then they get eaten, and once they're in the gut, then they get turned into a toxic form because the enzymes are sitting there starting to break stuff down. It turns into toxic form. It makes you sick or makes you die. Well, insects have evolved an enzyme that actually repackages it back into the non-toxic form, and then they just kind of move it around in their body and store it in different places so that they become toxic. So they've evolved the ability to not only not be killed by the toxin that the plant is actually making to protect itself from being eaten, but they now are immune to it, and they use it for their own purposes to keep their predators away. So this is how these insects are able to do both, have best of both worlds. They have a plant to make their toxin for them, and then they just eat the plant and take the armor and stick it in their body and prevent from getting eaten themselves. One of the examples of this, which you may be familiar with if you're a gardener, is tansy ragwort. And so I wanted to bring this back to gardening. Tansy ragwort's an introduced weed. You see it a lot in pastures. It's all over the place in the United States, and if cattle eat it, they die because it's really toxic. And they've tried to deal with this with chemicals for a long time. They finally brought over a natural pest of it. Now, this is a plant that's originally from Europe. And they brought over a moth that's called the cinnabar moth. It's a really pretty red butterfly. And the only things that it eats are tansies. So it eats a tansy. It's toxic, which is why it's got that nice bright red pattern. But since it doesn't eat anything except tansy, it's not a problem. And so if you've seen tansy before in this country, you may have seen these little red butterflies flying around it because that is their food source. So now all we have to do is figure out how to do this ourselves, and then we won't have to do decaffeinated coffee anymore. I saw you in the garden, baby. You look so debonair. Beware of the flowers, because I'm sure they're going to get you. Yeah. Since we're talking about bugs today and what's bugging you in good buggy ways or bad buggy ways, one of the things that we love to do is baby our ladybugs, because ladybugs are a gardener's best friend. They not only eat aphids, they eat a lot of different types of insect pests. And it's not the adults. It's not the little red ladybug you see flying around. By the way, it's toxic too, which is why it's got that red and black color. But it's their nymph form, which are called lions. I don't know if you've ever seen them before, but they're scary looking. They're long, and they just have these projections. They look like really scary little creatures. They look nothing like adult ladybugs. But anyway, they're the ones that are just all over the place eating things. They're pretty voracious eaters, and they eat a ton of different pests. But a lot of times it's hard to get enough ladybugs, it seems like, in our garden. So we tend to go to the garden center. Oh, they've got bags of ladybugs. Let's buy a bag of ladybugs and take them home. So we do that. We get these bags of ladybugs. We take them home. We open them up, and most of the time they fly away. And they're all gone because you have to have a lot of aphids in a place to keep those ladybugs around. So if you have a nursery or something and you have an aphid infestation, that's one thing. But if you've got a pretty clean yard, you're probably not going to stick around very long. So there's a really good economical reason for not buying the bag ladybugs, but there's actually more to it than just the economics of it. Most of these ladybugs are not your local ladybugs. They're from someplace else. So they're carted in from out of state. And not only are they from out of state, but they're not even from a farm. They're wild-caught ladybugs. So someone is going out and trapping ladybugs in the wild and capturing them and dragging them away from all their friends and neighbors and packaging them up and selling them. Which is really sad for the poor little ladybugs. But from a practical perspective, wild ladybugs have a lot of diseases. They have a lot of pests and of their own. So if you take those along with their little parasites and diseases and bag them and send them someplace else, and then you release those, then you're releasing all those parasites and diseases into your own landscape. So you're bringing disease in as well as the ladybugs. That's not a good thing. The second thing is, these are not your local population of ladybugs. There's lots of actually there's actually lots of different species of ladybugs. Some of them have few dots, some of them have lots of dots, some are yellow. You've probably seen different types before. So you have your own local populations of loyal little ladybugs that are sitting around taking care of your garden. And if you bring in these introduced ones, they sell them for a reason. It's because they're really pretty good at what they do. They will eat everything they can find, and they will reproduce like crazy, and they will pretty much outcompete everybody else. So it's one thing to bring in native ladybugs, maybe not your local population, but at least from the same country, but they're also selling you imported ladybugs, the Asian ladybugs in particular, which are just eating machines. They will eat everything they can find. If they can't find insect pests, they'll eat plant parts, and they will even eat the eggs and larvae of their competitor ladybugs. So they just eat everything. They're just, they're machines. So this is a very sad thing to do to your garden, because, you know, you're bringing in things that aren't native there. They'll pretty much wipe out whatever you've got, both friend and foe, and then they leave. They're not very grateful little guests. So it probably isn't the greatest thing in the world to buy at the nursery store. So I always advise against buying the ladybugs. There are other types of beneficial insects you can buy, green lace wings, other things that tend not to be as temporary as ladybugs are. So instead, what I do is recommend using natural types of ways to bring in your own populations of ladybugs and make them happy so they stick around. So that leads into my tips for the week. And this is on making your garden and landscape more hospitable to the good bugs so that your bad bugs don't drive you buggy. One of the best things you can do in having your garden is water. Now that again seems obvious, but I'm talking about actually a water feature. It doesn't have to be a huge water feature. It doesn't have to be a big, you know, big bubbling pond or anything like that. You can have a little tiny fountain that just has water trickling through it, and you'll see bees that will land on there and they'll get water. And so water is a really important thing to have. Standing water, don't do it. Mosquitoes love standing water. So you need to have a water feature, and just again, a little tabletop fountain is all you need. Second thing, you need a chunky mulch. Now, you know I love mulch, you know I love organic mulch, but you don't even have to have organic mulch if you like stones instead. But what that does, it creates habitat for a lot of really great predatory insects. Spiders love chunky mulch. Now, we don't want the spiders in our house necessarily, but we want them in our garden because they'll create little traps and they will trap all kinds of very pesty bugs. The third thing you want to have is a lot of vertical structure in your garden. So you want to have trees, you want to have shrubs, you want to have ground covers, you want to have all kinds of stuff because that's natural habitat. It gives places for insects to hide. Obviously, it gives place for other animals to hide as well, but it just gives you a lot more hiding places for a lot of diverse insect life. You want to obviously provide some food. Flowers are a natural food source for a lot of insects. And you've got to actually keep some of those pest insects around. It might seem contradictory, but you have to have some aphids in your garden, for instance, because if you don't have the aphids, then like with ladybugs, you know, you're not going to have the food to keep the beneficial insects around. What you want to have is a very low level of pests that you can manage with your native and natural predatory insects rather than just trying to wipe everything out. Which leads to the last part, which is avoiding pesticides and fertilizers. Pesticides are just going to wreak havoc on all insects. You can't target particular insects most of the time. So anything you spray is going to have repercussions down the road. Excess fertilizers creates problems in the soil. You're going to have nutrient imbalances. Plants are unhealthy. Soil is unhealthy. That's when pests and opportunistic diseases do well. So the pesticides you should try to eliminate as much as possible. Fertilizing only when absolutely necessary. Just keep the chemicals out of your yard. I know it's tough on podcasts to feel like you can have any kind of dialogue between the two of us. So I encourage you to go to Facebook and check out the Garden Professor's page. And you'll find out that there are many things about the blog there as well as podcasts. So that's a great way to get questions back to me that I can then cover on next week's podcast. Well, once again, thank you for joining me with my podcast. I hope you'll join me next time when my theme will be Garden Copycats. Until then, happy gardening.
You've been listening to The Informed Gardener, brought to you by Washington State University. For the show, more podcasts, and more information on gardening, please go to theinformedgardener.com.